Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 9 in 10 people who suffer a heart attack die in the process, often because bystanders are afraid to help or are unsure how to help, according to the American Heart Association. Yesterday, the Central Ohio Division of the American Heart Association unveiled a hands-only CPR training kiosk at the John Glenn Columbus International Airport. Joining us is the American Heart Association Central Ohio Executive Director, Brenda Houston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on here today.
First, tell us why so few people know how to administer CPR. It's like something that everybody knows what it is, right?
I think people, in theory, know what it is. And I think the barrier to doing CPR is the thought of doing a mouth-to-mouth that is part of the process. And that's why we recommend that the association doing hands-only compressions. We know if those compressions are happening at the proper level, they keep the blood and the heart pumping and has proven effective and survival rates increasing 2 to 3 times more than if a victim did not receive those compressions.
People are also afraid of doing harm.
Yes. Yes. And the American Heart Association has been very instrumental through the years, not only in the development of the science that created CPR originally, but refining those guidelines and the science around CPR training. But we've also been huge advocates in passing legislation that actually protects the bystander so they won't be necessarily in trouble for performing CPR. And we say some CPR, even performed poorly, can improve outcomes dramatically compared to no CPR.
Do people know enough about the symptom or what a person having a heart attack looks like?
You know, if they don't, I wish that they would. So my personal passion is educating our community on the warning signs and symptoms of a cardiac arrest. And the best way to do that is to inform yourself and go to our website at www.heart.org. And knowing those signs are critical. But the first thing to do if you see somebody who is non-responsive and you approach them, always call 911. That's your first step. The next thing to do is to see if their chest is rising and if they're breathing, and then start the compressions if you see that the individual either has no pulse or their chest is not rising.
But the difference between women and men, that's another issue. We had a woman who was listening to a program at NPR. I had her on the show on Wellness Wednesday a couple years ago. And she was listening to the description of symptoms in women, and she thought, you know what? That's what I'm having. And she went, instead of going to her job, she went to the hospital, and she had a heart attack in the emergency waiting room.
Well, I'm very sorry she had a heart attack, but I'm very happy that she survived and sought medical attention. And I think having a personal story myself, having lost my mom at a young age to a heart attack, knowing those signs and symptoms is really critical. And heart attacks can present differently in women. Oftentimes it can be related to being extremely fatigued, pain in the neck and shoulders. And these symptoms are symptoms that we might feel every single day.
I had a pinched nerve that I was swore was a heart attack symptom.
Yes, yes. And we say better safe than sorry. Be your own health advocate and call your doctor. Have that conversation. In this day and age, with cardiovascular disease taking the lives of nearly 1 out of every 2 Americans, it's very important that we have these conversations. And it knows no age. It doesn't discriminate.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about cardiac arrest, how to identify it when it's happening, and how to treat it if you're a bystander. My guest is Brenda Houston. She's the American Heart Association Central Ohio Executive Director. They have just put a CPR training kiosk in the John Glenn Columbus International Airport. It's part of a larger effort by the American Heart Association to install these kiosks. Why airports?
Well, we try to place kiosk in the areas where there is the most traffic or opportunity for individuals to learn the skill. So high traffic areas,
malls
where people are waiting around or have some time to pass. And this marks our 13th airport in the country that we've placed a kiosk. And it's actually the 29th kiosk in the country overall, but the 13th airport.
I guess 13th airport, airports are places where there's lots of people who also lots of people just hanging around.
Yes, lots of people hanging around. And we actually have had some great feedback from actually a story out of a young man named Matt, who's a University of Dayton student who was in the Dallas airport. And he took some time in the Dallas airport on a trip to learn CPR on the device. He did it three times. It's a mannequin machine. He wanted to win. It's a gamification. So he did it three times to get 100% score. And little did he know, about 2 weeks later, he had to perform that life-saving skill on a fellow student who'd been struck by lightning. And he was able to save his fellow student because he learned this in his downtime in the Dallas airport.
Tell us what the kiosk looks like. And you said it's gamification, so there's a fun aspect to this. It's not all study, study, study.
Yes, I do think there's a fun aspect, but people want to get the score. The kiosk looks has a mannequin that's included, a touch screen, an overhead screen. It also plays learning videos and instructional. And it really just takes about 30 seconds. And it also provides a CPR test at the end to give you feedback on how deep your compressions were. I was speaking to somebody who was there who participated at our event yesterday, and he said, I want to keep learning, and it's really prompted me to get more training because I could only do the compressions at a 40% rate.
Because that's all he could do.
Right.
Because you want to do it to the Bee Gees' Staying Alive.
That's
beat.
Right. Staying alive. Staying alive.
If you have a question or comment about CPR, give us a call. My guest is Brenda Houston. She's the American Heart Association Central Ohio Executive Director. And we're talking about a new CPR learning kiosk that's been installed in the John Glenn Columbus International Airport. It's one of 13 across the country there in airports. And then there's others in other locations. It's part of a larger effort by the American Heart Association. The number to call is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When did CPR training become a thing? It hasn't always been a thing.
Well, I would say it was developed in the 1990s, where it's become more of a...
So it is pretty recent then.
I would say it in the 90s, or it's not the 90s. So it was developed a long time ago, but where we started refining and making the CPR kits more available to the community, it was really how the Heart Association started their business, was going out teaching people with mannequins in communities with the big, what we call Annies, teaching people CPR. It was really part of the first grassroots effort of the organization. Then I'd say over time, the development of advanced cardiac life support happened, where there's instructions for medical professionals. And then the next evolution was really the development of the hands-only technique. And in 2007, in collaboration with other nonprofits, the organization worked to declare the days of June 1st through the 7th as National CPR Awareness Week.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Did we're used to hearing about like the defibrillators being installed in public places.
Yes. And so part of the Heart Association's effort is really related to advocacy efforts. In addition to advocating to have first responders placed in in public places and in first responding vehicles, the Heart Association just recently worked to pass legislation, House Bill 113 in 2016, which makes CPR education, hands-only CPR education, part of the requirement for all high school students before they graduate. And so a part of that training is not only learning the hands-only technique, but also educating them on the usage of an AED.
Peggy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. I was wondering if you could tell me, from personal experience, how you tell when a person, when you find a person, if they've had cardiac arrest or a stroke or something else like that. And the second part of the question would be, what kind of time are you facing when you find a person that may have suffered cardiac arrest before you begin the CPR? How much time lapses? Because I wonder if there's brain damage that can occur in between that period of time that you begin the CPR.
So I would say that time loss is either brain loss or muscle loss. So time is really critical. And our very first step that we recommend is call 911, especially if you approach a victim who is unconscious. It's very hard to tell what made them go unconscious. So always call 911. And then from there, it's looking, listening, and feeling to see if they there's any breathing or the chest is rising or falling. If the victim is not breathing and you do not see the chest rising or falling, that's a good indication to begin CPR. Also, listen to the instruction from your 911 operator. There is a difference if you do see somebody fall and if you see them fall suddenly. We recommend you go to our website at heart.org to look for some of those typical symptoms. A stroke patient typically has numbness or weakness. Their one side of their face might start drooping, and you'll notice slurring in their speech. Again, call 911, work with your 911 operator, and they will instruct you on steps to take.
They can help you through CPR?
Absolutely. What I'd like to recommend today is that everybody take time. You can Google hands-only CPR. It can take as little as 3 to 5 minutes to educate yourself on this life-saving process. And those resources we can empower ourselves with. In the event of an emergency, you'll be able to perform the life-saving skills, but our 911 operators are prepared to talk someone through these steps.
Thank you, Peggy, for that call. We have an email from Adam who writes, I learned how to do CPR in high school with mannequins, but so many friends of mine never learned at all. Seems like a common thread. Shouldn't schools and health classes be required to teach CPR? And you talked about that.
Yes,
thank you. That's changing.
Yes, we support that comment. And so what I'm excited about was with House Bill 113, over 100,000 students each year will be graduating throughout the state of Ohio with this life-saving skill. And the idea here is that individuals start to be very comfortable. So the more that we're educating, the more that we're making this as a normal part of education and process, we hope that individuals will feel more comfortable stepping up in a case of emergency.
Are you not supposed to give oral resuscitation anymore? Or is it just the point that people seem to be more hesitant to do that?
So in order to be fully certified in CPR, we recommend the breathing method. The hands-only part is really because we know that we can save lives if we just keep the heart pumping and that everybody can do that. And the barrier's been, in many cases, people did not want to give the rescue breath. So to be formally certified in CPR, you would take the rescue breathing portion of the class. But we know as long as we keep the blood pumping through the body that has oxygen in it, we can save more lives.
Brenda Houston, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. If you have any more questions, please don't hesitate to visit our website at www.heart.org.
Heart.org. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. That's Brenda Houston. She's the American Heart Association Central Ohio Executive Director. The American Heart Association Central Ohio has installed a CPR learning kiosk in the John Glenn Columbus International Airport. So check it out. It's in the B terminal. and check it out. I'm going to when I return from a trip coming up this summer. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 1,000 children drown every year, mostly between May and August. Another 7,000 children end up in the emergency room because of a near drowning. And most of all of those incidents occur in open water, that is lakes, oceans, and rivers, according to a new report by Safe Kids Worldwide. That's a global nonprofit working to prevent childhood injury. Joining us by phone is the medical director of Safe Kids Worldwide in Washington, D.C., Dr. Sadiqa Kendi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
The study found that open water was a key here. In other words, these kids can swim, but open water figured in a lot to their to the threat.
Definitely. Open water is much more dangerous for kids even than pools, and that's why we find that more kids drown in open water. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. One is that it's often hard to anticipate distance when you're out in open water. So the distance, for example, from where you are to the coast, it's often difficult to judge how deep the water is, and there can be significant changes very quickly. So there's not always kind of a gradual increase in the depth, and so it's harder for kids to gauge the water. And then the temperature of the water can often be much colder, which makes it harder to really navigate safely. So even children who can swim are at more risk when they're in open water.
What about things like riptides and undertows?
Definitely. That's the other thing. You know, there can be currents that are really difficult to pick up that you may not see on the surface. And even for a very strong adult swimmer, those currents can pull people under. And you've, I'm sure, heard reports of even adult swimmers who have drowned because of a riptide or a current. And so you can imagine a child, even a child who's a really strong swimmer, could get caught in something like that. And as I said, it's very hard to anticipate that. And that, of course, increases the risk.
Older kids appear more at risk, especially teenagers. Why is that?
I think there are a few reasons for that. One is supervision. So one thing we know is that supervision and even having a buddy for an older teenager when they're swimming is really important. If they're older and they're out, for example, and get caught in a riptide or a current, if they're not there with someone, then they're in trouble. You know, there's really no one to help them. And unfortunately, you know, there are more drownings in lakes and rivers. And one of the thoughts is that it's because there aren't lifeguards many times in those environments. And so you have older kids who feel very comfortable swimming in those environments, but because there's no supervision, because there's no lifeguard, when they get caught in those situations, then there's no help, and so it's higher risk for them.
And of course, teenagers take they're more risk taking, right?
Exactly, they're more risk taking, and then there can be the combination with alcohol and drugs as well, which, you know, also increases the risk of drowning.
And the supervision piece, I mean, a lot of times you think once a kid gets to be 10 or 12, you know they can swim. You're maybe not watching them as closely.
Exactly. But it's important to realize that any child, any age needs to be supervised, whether it's open water or pool. But especially in open water, they need that supervision because of those things that are hard to anticipate that we talked about.
We're talking about swimming and drowning kids, why kids do drown, what are the circumstances. Open water plays a big part in it. Supervision plays another part. My guest is Dr. Sadiqa Kendi. She's the medical director of Safe Kids Worldwide in Washington, D.C. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. African-American children are twice as likely to drown. What do you make of that?
Unfortunately, that is the case, and I think a lot of it is just because historically there has not been access to swimming lessons, access to pools, just because of the history in our country. Athabascan Native and American Indian children are even more likely to drown as well, and I think it's the same story. Unfortunately, our history, I think,
of segregation and Jim Crow, right?
Right.
So yeah. That means that that maybe their parents didn't learn, or their parents didn't learn because their parents didn't learn, and it's like a cultural thing that's passed down that needs to change.
Right. And I think when a parent isn't comfortable in the water, they might allow the child to go out, but then they're not able to provide the close supervision that's needed. So for a young child, for example, it's recommended that they be arm's length from the parent, be arm's length from the child. And so if you have a parent and child who aren't comfortable in water, then again, that's an increased risk because they're not going to be able to supervise as well. So, you know, I think these things can pass down generations, unfortunately.
Yeah. And there are gender differences as well. Boys are more likely. Again, is that a risk-taking thing or what?
You know, I think that it's a few things. I think risk-taking is one, and I think supervision may be the other thing. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes boys aren't supervised as closely because it's thought, oh, well, they're okay or they're a little stronger. And you know, that increases the risk of them drowning or getting caught in a riptide and drowning. So I think it's both risk-taking and supervision.
Obviously, more kids drown during warm months because that's when we're swimming in pools and rivers and lakes and so forth. Is there a time of day that's notable?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I think it is during the day more often than at night, just because, again, if you look at the numbers, that's when kids are more likely to be swimming. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even during other seasons, like in the winter, the risk is kids who are out playing on frozen ponds, for example, and fall through. And so even though we see a large uptick in the number of drownings during the summer, they still occur, and we still have to be aware of these even during other seasons.
Do life jackets help?
Life jackets definitely help. The Coast Guard approved life jackets are important. Those life jackets need to fit properly. And it's important to remember that life jackets are different from the little floaties that can be used. So anything that you blow up with your mouth is kind of a cute floaty that goes on the arms or something that is blown up and put around the waist. That is not something that can prevent drowning. You really need a Coast Guard approved life jacket to assist with preventing drowning.
Why is that? Why won't a floaty help when someone's drowning?
A floaty may not help for a few reasons. One, it's not made to fit as well, so it can easily slide off. And so you can imagine a small child, you know, they can be quite wiggly and get through anything, and a small child could just slip through any of those floaties. The other issue is they can pop, air can leak out of them, and so if the air is not there, it's not floating, and it's not helpful. And so there are just too many risks for that not to actually support the child or not to stay on the child to keep them above water.
You know, we just did a segment on CPR training. The American Heart Association is putting kiosks in airports across the country and other places where there's high traffic, teaching people how to do CPR. That is a life-saving skill when it comes to drowning, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's very important for all parents, whether their child swims or not, I think it's important for all parents to be CPR trained. I mean, it's a life-saving skill, and it's something that you never know when you'll have to use, and it's good to have that knowledge.
We have an email from Tricia in Columbus. She says, I don't live near open water, but my kid is learning to swim in school. Listening to this, it seems like a problem. How can we teach or prepare kids to swim in the open? So what kind of conversations can we be having with our kids when we do go to the lake, when we go to the river, wherever?
I think it's both the conversations with the kids, but also the mindset of the adults who are with the kids. Both of those are very important. And I think in terms of the mindset for the kids, it's making sure that they understand that even though they can swim, they still need to let the parent know, whether it's a younger child or an adolescent, they need to let the parent know where they're going, and the adolescent who's going with a friend, what body of water they're going to. They need to be able to look for if there are any signs. So, you know, there's certain open water areas that have already been evaluated by professionals, and they know that there are safe spaces. And so usually there are signs that say that. And so looking for those signs can be important. So those are things that the kids can do. I think for parents is always having someone who is the designated water watcher. So someone who their only job is to watch the water and watch the children. One thing we know is that drowning does not happen the way it happens in the movies. In the movies, there's lots of splashing and arms waving and noise, and that is not often how it happens. It's very quiet, and it happens quickly. And so you don't actually get all of those warning signs that you might see in the movies. And so because of that, any adult who's watching the water has to be very alert and can't be distracted by anything.
And if you do see somebody that's struggling, you see something that's amiss, how do you, I mean, saving somebody from drowning is hard.
It is very hard. It is very hard. And that's why it's helpful to swim places where there is a lifeguard or someone else who is actually certified in how to save someone who's drowning. I mean, there was a recent report on an adult who drowned trying to save two children in the ocean. And I mean, unfortunately, this happens because there are specific ways to do it. And I think that's one reason to make sure you're swimming in a place where, one, you already know that it's a safer space to swim, but two, where there are lifeguards.
You know, is there enough opportunity for people to learn how to swim these days?
You know, I think that there are opportunities. There are probably never enough because, you know, we need to make sure that everyone, no matter their socioeconomic status, no matter where they live, no matter, you know, what their schedule is and how busy the parent is or what other whatever things they have on their plate, we need to find a way to make sure everyone has access to swim lessons. And, you know, in order to take swim lessons, you have to have a swimsuit. You know, there's certain things that you have to have, mm-hmm. which can be challenging for families who have less resources.
Right.
And so I think there's always more we can do to make swim lessons more accessible.
So as far as adults in drowning, what's the situation there? Is that getting better? You know, there was a thing where the drowning issue was improving for many years, and then there's been an uptick in recent years. Do you have any idea why that is?
You know, I'm not sure why that is. And in our report, we couldn't identify what it was that was causing the increase over the past few years. There was a recent report by the CDC that unintentional injuries in general for kids has increased over the last few years. So that's even outside of drowning, other types of injuries. And I think that's something that warrants a lot more research for us to figure out what the problem is and what it is that has changed that's causing these injuries to start to trend back up.
You know, and I know you're here to talk about drowning in particular, but are there other summertime threats out there that people should be paying attention to if you're going to the beach?
Oh, definitely. So just how to manage the sun is one, and also managing hot cars and just the heat in general. Mm. And so sunblock is really important. I work in the pediatric emergency department, and I've seen plenty of children who come in with very severe sunburns, and we actually classify them as burns because they can actually be pretty severe. And then, of course, in the heat, we have to remember how to make sure that we're staying cool. You know, kids need to be out of the sun. They need to be drinking plenty of fluid. And then I think the other issue is kids in hot cars and making sure the kids are not left in cars, especially during this season. It can be very dangerous, and the temperature goes up very quickly. It can be dangerous for kids.
What about bug bites or anything like that?
You know, for that, just using insect repellent, I think, is very helpful. Generally, the bug bites themselves are not dangerous. But, of course, now, you know, we're dealing with various mosquitoes that are carrying various illnesses, especially depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. And so that's something else that we have to think about. But insect repellent, and then thinking about if a child's going to be somewhere where they're going to be in taller grass or in a forest or something, you know, having longer pants so that their skin is not exposed. Longer pants while still having something that is ventilated well so that they're not getting overheated.
Dr. Sadiqa Kendi, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Wait, we might have another question. Hang on a second.
Okay, sure.
We have an email from Alexis. She says, why are children allowed to swim in open waters like this? Isn't it illegal for kids to be out in open waters? I don't think so.
As far as I know, I don't think it's illegal, actually, for kids to be swimming in open waters. And, I mean, if you think about it, kids are in open water oceans all the time.
Right.
And then if you think of kids who live near lakes and rivers, I mean, that's often one of the sources of entertainment for kids. But, as far as I know, it is not illegal. But I definitely think that if it's done, it has to be done with supervision. And, I mean, that's really the key for all unintentional injuries. Supervision is very important. And with the water, it's, you know, having that water watcher who is just watching the surface of the water, having someone who's arm's length if it's a younger child, and if it's an older child, having them close enough so that they can get to the child quickly if the child ended up in trouble, you know, making sure that it's a safe water. So if it's somewhere that has a lifeguard or at least has been evaluated by a professional, that's really helpful. And then making sure kids know how to swim as well.
Again, Dr. Sadiqa Kendi, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Sadiqa Kendi is the medical director of Safe Kids Worldwide in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about, you know, how to prevent drownings among children and older, young children and older children alike. We'll have more Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Five people have died and nearly 200 have been sickened across the country from an E. coli outbreak that started in mid-March. Federal investigators have determined that the E. coli came from contaminated romaine lettuce grown in Arizona, but so far have been unable to pinpoint the specific grower. Most of us can't control the practices of growers, but we can observe food handling practices that lower our chances of spreading deadly foodborne bacteria to our bodies. Clemson University professor Paul Dawson studies how common food habits can hurt our chances. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. My pleasure.
Tell us what E. coli is and why it's so dangerous.
E. coli, well, there's various types of E. coli. Actually, most E. coli, the genus species, are harmless, but there are a few that obviously are not, and it's a bacterium. And the type of bacterium that made people sick and killed five people you just spoke about actually is a strain called 015787. So a specific type of E. coli that produces a toxin once it gets inside the body. And the toxin is called a virotoxin and attacks the organs. And unfortunately, there's no, once that organism sets up house and starts producing a toxin, there's no good antidote, so to speak, to stop that. And it's a way to have to survive that attack once infected. So again, that's the specific type of E. coli. And again, most E. coli are in nature are harmless. So there are a few types that obviously are not, and that's the one that made people sick.
Is there anything people can do to avoid contamination from produce they've purchased besides washing it?
That's a real, you know, when I read, you know, read the story and try to keep up with the news, that that type of thing is very, very difficult. It's kind of scary, you think, when you go to a restaurant and order a salad, think you're actually eating, you know, you are eating a healthy meal, and then it makes you sick. And the people who, I guess, that got sick in this case probably, again, unless they bought themselves and washed it, were kind of caught off guard. Interesting, when I happened to be out in California when this first happened, and I went to a meal and just not even thinking ordered a salad, and they mentioned that they had no romaine. They had already stopped the use of any romaine lettuce at that time. So that's the good news, I guess, that we have a very active prevention system in the U.S., and when an outbreak occurs, the news travels very quickly, and people try to stop it as soon as possible. But again, in this case, there are cases like these that, other than washing the raw food, there's not much you can do.
You've written that E. coli bacteria transfers to wet lemons and ice 100% of the time, but only about a third of the time when they're dry. What does wet or dry have to do with anything?
Yeah, we've done several studies like that, some of our undergrads and grad students. And that's true in most cases. Wet surfaces or wet foods will pick up bacteria more quickly. Obviously, bacteria are living organisms, and they like moisture and adhere better and attracted to that surface. So, in our case, we inoculated again, and these were kind of benchtop studies. So we were just trying to demonstrate some of the things that would cause that transfer. So again, wet surfaces, wet food, bacteria are more likely to survive and also be transferred to.
We're talking about the spread of common food bacteria and how you can avoid the spread of the dangerous stuff. My guest is a professor of food safety at Clemson University, Paul Dawson. If you have a question or comment about food safety, this is the time to call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It is the season for picnics. That is a particular problem, Paul Dawson?
Yes, it is. And again, the CDC has some good tips out there. And I guess, you know, we all know this, but the common sense is they have four things they recommend. That's clean, that is wash your hands, wash surfaces where you handle raw food, separate raw food from cooked food, cook it to a safe temperature, and then once cooked, either keep it warm or chill it. And so that's kind of the four things they have highlighted, clean, separate, cook, and chill. And especially when you mentioned eating picnics and outdoors, we tend to have food away from the kitchen where there's not maybe readily available refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
And so being aware of that, having the food cold and making sure it's cold enough that the cooler doesn't run out of coolant, whether it's ice or one of the cool packs. And then you're going to heat it, have outdoor stove or whatever, make sure it's cooked at the proper temperature.
I've wondered about sometimes people put things on ice, so they maybe have a tray of deviled eggs and they put it on ice. Is that going to be enough if it's not enveloped in chill air?
Yeah, that's a good point. An example of that, you're exactly right. If something's warm, food's warm and you want to chill it, obviously, the more surface area, the better.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a thick plate or something, casserole or whatever, and you try to chill that down, the center is not going to cool down as quickly. And if you're outdoors, it may not, in a cooler, it may not cool down rapidly. An extreme example of that, years ago, and it probably still occurs, pallets of food are frozen and chilled, and we get called for some consulting every once in a while. And one example of that was chicken was being shipped overseas. And these were pallets of chicken in boxes, and the product arrived frozen. But when they thawed it, the center appeared to be spoiled. And what had happened? That pallet did not cool down quickly enough in the middle, and so it spoiled, but then froze. So it was frozen, but it had spoiled before that. So that's kind of an extreme example of what might happen on a smaller scale if you don't, like you mentioned, have enough cool air or cool ice and coolant and a large thick food product.
Speaking of ice, what about using a scoop for ice? Does that make a difference?
Yeah, you see that most people usually have a scoop or a cup that they, if I'm kind of interpreting what you're asking, a scoop that they use the scoop ice rather than someone sticking their cup in there they've used to drink out of. So that's kind of I see that most places, most people do that, use one generic scoop or a cup rather than stick your own cup in there, so to speak.
Well, I mean, one of the issues is a lot of the problems are on our hands, and that's why you said washing your hands is a good thing.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. I mean, one of the more common, I think it's number five on the causing illnesses in the United States is Staphylococcus aureus, and that's staph in general, are associated with human skin, and oftentimes that is transferred to the food product. And it's that particular type of organism actually produces a toxin outside the body, so when the food's not kept cold or heated, it can grow and produce that toxin. Then once the toxin is produced, you eat it and get sick. I call that one kind of, because I got it one time, the salad bar food poisoning, because they had someone handled it and not kept it cold. And then, again, you can't taste it. You have no way of knowing. It looks fine. So it's kind of catch you off guard.
What about salad bars? You don't see them as much anymore. What are your thoughts about those?
Well, yeah, they kind of went from a very small version to some of the larger chains had these long food bars or whatever, and they kind of, I guess, maybe gone full pendulum. We still have them around here in some cases. I won't say any trade names, but mm-hmm. has its own issues because you have people, non-food service personnel, going up and handling scoops and touching different parts of the ladles and whatever to get food out, then someone mm-hmm. goes behind them. So you're kind of at a communal or place where you don't know the person ahead of you what their hygiene practices are, so to speak. So that may be one of the concerns. And again, that's maybe not a big risk, but it certainly is a way that germs and things are spread.
Our counters are common collectors of yucky stuff, especially if you just don't clean it. But just wiping it off with water isn't good enough, right?
No, that's probably not going to do it. What happens sometimes if you don't clean a surface right away is the bacteria will form what's called a biofilm. And those biofilms are all much like on a larger scale, like I call them, I make them into a coral reef. The bacteria actually work together. Multiple types of bacteria can work together and form a very resistant kind of a colony on that surface. And once that's formed, it's virtually impossible to kill that without actually physical scrubbing. So, yeah, it's very important to clean all the surfaces as soon as possible before they form a biofilm, because then it's easier to get them off. And then even then, kind of scrub it to make sure you get them off. I guess one of them everyone can relate to in biofilm would be in the morning when you wake up and brush your teeth. Overnight, you kind of see that little layer on there, and you feel that in your teeth, and that's the bacteria maybe forming a biofilm.
You know, how can you tell if a biofilm has been formed? Is it not always obvious?
No, it would probably not be obvious to the naked eye. Obviously, they're called microorganisms for a reason. We can't,
yeah,
can't
right.
see them with naked eye. So if it's a, you may be able to see a crust sometimes if it's a really highly developed biofilm, but yeah. Normally at the early stages, you would not be able to see that with the naked eye.
There are some products out there that cleaning cloths that are infused with silver, natural antibiotic, I guess. What are your thoughts about those?
Yes, yeah, silver and copper are both natural, have natural activity against bacteria. If it's a silver infused product or sponge, it's going to keep the sponge or the product. Reduce the bacteria on that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it has any magical powers if you scrub it on a surface, though. The surface will still be just as difficult to get the bacteria off with or without that silver. I think it prevents the spread. Now, we've heard about sponges mm-hmm. being harboring bacteria, or possibly because they're wet all the time, and mm-hmm. you use them to make food, scrub food up, and if they're not clean, then they will actually grow bacteria themselves. I think that's the case if it's some type of triclosan or sponge infused with some type of antimicrobial.
Mm-hmm. So what about sponges? How often should you throw it out?
Yeah, I guess it depends on how much you use it. I wouldn't say there's a standard time to throw it out. I know, I guess, probably every 2-3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, if you use it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people either put it in the dishwasher, put it in a microwave, things like that. I'm not sure it's a good practice or not, but certainly those high temperatures will kill and sterilize the sponge.
Are you a fan of sponges in general, or what?
I don't like them when they're really old.
Yeah.
Stay wet in the sink. I mean, we have one that stays constantly wet in the sink. So, you know, after a while, I kind of feel like it's carrying some germs.
I mean, they come in packages of 10 for a reason. Throw it out, right?
Right. Yeah, don't cost very much.
What about alcohol? Can that kill off bacteria and contamination? Is there something like that you can use?
Yeah, alcohol is a good alternative. We did a study on hand washing, and one thing is that if you get the bacteria, as I mentioned, they form biofilms, and if you get the bacteria off the surface, I mean, the best proper policy, I think, is to remove the bacteria. That's washing your hands, wash them off your hands,
mm-hmm.
alcohol sanitizers, obviously, will, as a follow-up, would be good. They kill bacteria, but again, if bacteria is on your hands, the alcohol sanitizer are not as effective as far as hands as washing is. That's what we found anyway. So yes, if the bacteria is kind of free and loose, so to speak, and gets in contact with the alcohol, it will kill them. And again, it's better than nothing. But compared to hand washing, again, the biofilm and scrubbing, and our hands obviously have, you ever looked at the hand under a microscope, the skin has like nooks and crannies. Bacteria can hide there. So, and it's good for killing viruses. You'll hear that in flu season is, you know, everybody has alcohol sanitizers around. Mm-hmm. So they're good, but the old-fashioned hand washing is, I think, is the best.
You know, I hear about people, they get flu bugs a lot, intestinal flu bugs a lot, and sometimes I wonder, do they, or do some people live with this more often than they realize that they're suffering from foodborne illness?
Oh, that's definitely the case. Whether it's the flu or any type of infection from a foodborne source, mm-hmm. The CDC, and probably everybody is tired of hearing the statistics, but you know, they estimate, you know, 148 million people get sick a year, and those are all estimates based on the known number of illnesses, because most people either get a mild case and pass it off as I just got a flu bug, or they call mm-hmm. it, or a stomach ache or whatever, and they're better in a day or so. And we don't know how many of those are never reported. Obviously, they are not reported, and how many of those are due to food-borne illnesses. So, yeah, by far most are mild cases, and we don't really know the sources. But, in fact, some statistics are of the known cases of food-borne illness, only 31% are of known sources. So by far most are not really known what the source is.
Double dipping. So whoever wrote this question said it's a common practice. It is not a common practice in my house, but we'll leave that to another conversation. But what about the old double dipping with the carrot stick in the dip?
Yeah, well, I think there may be referencing at one of the studies papers we published, and actually have a book coming out on some of those practices in November. You know, again, those are difficult to determine how much that, or if any, that causes food, or not foodborne illness, but actually transferring of flu or whatever. But we demonstrated was that, in fact, if you do double dip, you are transferring your oral bacteria to the dip. So during flu season, and you're in a Super Bowl party or whatever, there's a chance that someone's sick there, that, and multiple times going to the dip, back to the dip, that mm-hmm. is going to transfer it. That was kind of a fun study, but again, I guess the point was trying to demonstrate that there are very serious consequences. That, you know, we talk about numbers, and that doesn't really, it's kind of cold. But when you know somebody, you go to the hospital, and actually, you know, we talked about these deaths, the impact of that is really devastating. And being aware, by far most of these cases are preventable by common practice. The ones we talked about again earlier were probably not, but most of them are. So that's kind of the point. Yeah, the old double dip. Maybe you end up feeling a little ill the next day, and maybe you pick something up from the dip.
Paul Dawson, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Paul Dawson, professor of food safety at Clemson University. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.